Morning, Council. We've discussed the matter, and what we'd like to do is discuss and get your positions on your motion that was filed on Monday, and then address the merits of the appeal thereafter. So let's start with the motion. So Ms. Lovell, if you want to start, and because you're a mouvant,
thank you, Your Honor, and I apologize for the lateness of the motion. As you know, this appeal arose out of a dispute about the proper definition of height to apply to developments in Maui. And the court below granted summary judgment to I will call them the plaintiffs, if that's all right with you, just because we are cross appellants, appellees, and so forth, granted summary judgment to the plaintiffs and enjoined the county from issuing building permits for 158 lots in two mass-graded subdivisions in a zoning area known as the Maui Lani Project District, which is located in central Maui. The injunction covered any residence that might be built if the result would have it be more than 30 feet in height as measured from the natural rather than the finished grade. And then just a couple of weeks ago, on August 28, 2011, the Maui County Council enacted Maui Ordinance Number 3848, which we submitted to the court as a supplemental authority. I believe that was filed on September 7th, and it's docket number 113 in the record before this court. And in that ordinance, the county council clarified that the definition of height that was in effect at the time that the Maui Lani Project District was first approved is to be applied to developments within that district. Now, the parties have been discussing settlements for some time. It's a multi-party, multi-phase set of appeals and legal issues. We are 99% of the way there, but we don't have a firm settlement on the record that I can present to the court. However, the one thing that I believe all parties agree is that justice would best be served, and all of our clients' interests would be served, albeit for very different reasons, if this court were to remand all of the appeals back to the circuit court so that the circuit court could take this new ordinance into effect.
Right, but we already have a final judgment entered in the circuit court. Why do you need to remand this? You can't, assuming you are able to settle the outstanding issues, can't you just settle them and be done?
We are concerned about a permanent injunction that is in place
But wouldn't it make more sense to have the settlement before you go back? Because, I mean, we'll get to the other parties, I guess, but it sounds like 99 is not 100, right?
Exactly, and that is precisely our dilemma, that there are still a few details left to be resolved. But I can speak only from the county's perspective, and that is our main concern is that at the end of the day, once we reach settlements with everyone, that the injunction that currently is in place be lifted or dissolved. That is our goal. That is not necessarily the goal of the other parties, and I cannot speak for them. As I say, I believe all parties want a remand, but for different reasons.
Ms. Lovell, in your motion, you discuss a number of different options, the appellate conference program and dismissal and remand. In your mind, or just speaking for yourself for the moment, what is the difference between a remand and a dismissal of this appeal?
Our concern, Your Honor, was that if we only dismissed, if we all agreed just to dismiss, because all of us are appellants in one way or another, that we might not be able to achieve any relief that we believe only the circuit court can grant, namely the lifting of the injunction. I believe this court, certainly if it hears the merits and decides to overturn the court's appeal, could remand back to the circuit court. But my understanding, perhaps imperfect understanding, of appellate procedure is that this court would not directly lift the injunction, that it would more likely, if it ruled in the county's favor, order the court below to do so.
Counsel, is it your understanding that all the parties have agreed that the injunction must now be lifted? Is that part of the agreement?
No, Your Honor. Okay. I cannot go that far. Okay. That is certainly the county's goal, but I don't believe...
But there's no agreement on that part?
No.
And counsel, one of the things that your motion is very brief, I understand. It was filed in an expeditious manner, given the timing of the oral argument. But one of the things that it doesn't address is jurisdiction in terms of the remand. And I think that's certainly something that would be of concern for this court. Have you addressed that or considered that?
I have, but only insofar as trying to figure out intellectually the order of a dismissal and a remand. I believe if the court dismisses and remands as a part of the dismissal order, and I understand that you have jurisdiction to do that, then the lower court will regain jurisdiction and will be able to entertain such further proceedings as may be necessary. Our concern was that if the court merely dismissed, that we would not have a vehicle for presenting arguments that this change in the law or this clarification of the law really renders large portions of the dispute moot.
But there's no discussion in the remand motion in terms of, for instance, it's not something where you folks are seeking a 60B type motion, or there's no reference whatsoever as to the vehicle through which you would go back before the circuit court, and that would be of concern for us.
Yes, I understand, and part of our difficulty is because we have all parties agreeing on the result, but not the reasons for getting there. I felt constrained against making a particular argument that would result in the undoing or the modification of the judgment.
So bottom line, at this juncture, there's no agreement amongst the parties as to that process?
I believe that is correct.
Okay, thank you.
So are there any points of fact or law that the parties now agree on that were previously briefed in this appeal?
I believe, and certainly my opposing colleagues will let you know, but I believe that all parties would agree that the passage of the ordinance effective August 28th and made explicitly retroactive changes the landscape. How it does so may be a point of disagreement. And I'm trying not to get into the merits because I believe we will be there in a few minutes unless we can work this out. The other possibility that I considered might work would be a Rule 33 conference, which of course allows the court to consider simplification of the issues and such other matters as may aid in the disposition of the case by the appellate court. And again, if such a conference were convened, the county would certainly argue that the ordinance changes everything. I'm not sure that my opposing counsel on both sides would agree. But.
All right. Well, why don't we hear from counsel first? Mr. Collins, do you want to put your position, since we haven't heard from you yet, on the motion?
Sure. Aloha and good morning.
Good morning.
I think the agreement, at least with regards to our clients, is that we do agree to dismiss all of the appeals and have the matter remanded back to the circuit court. We do believe that the circuit court does have continuing jurisdiction once it's remanded over the permanent injunction. that is the common law of permanent injunctions, but also because the order of the court says that the injunction will continue until further order of the court. And so it is our position that if all of the appeals are dismissed by agreement of the parties and remanded, that the circuit court would have jurisdiction to entertain further proceedings for the parties to discuss whether or not the passage of ordinance.
Well, you reference common law. What case would you cite in support of that?
Off the top of my head, I don't have a citation. I can send it to you, but the U.S. v. Swift Company, which is a U.S. Supreme Court case from the 1930s, and they say that the power of the court there says that the power of a permanent injunction includes within it the power to modify it, because it's a equitable power of the court that part of equity is the change in circumstances and the change that comes with time, and so the court sitting in equity always has the power to modify its decrees.
Mr. Collins, just to be clear, your agreement to dismiss all appeals is contingent on everyone else's agreement. You're not unilaterally willing to dismiss based on the passage of this ordinance.
No, and actually, we don't agree whether or not the ordinance has an effect on the merits of the case below, except for how it relates to whether or not we're entitled to attorney's
fees. So you think the ordinance impacts your private attorney general doctrine?
Yes, in a beneficial way.
Okay.
With respect to whether or not the ordinance is applicable to the facts in this case and all of that is something that has not been briefed, and right. Our clients have not been able to have the full opportunity to take a position on any of that.
And there's no specific agreement with the other parties as to what the meaning of it is to this particular case?
No, but I think that we agree that if all of the appeals are jointly dismissed and this matter is remanded back to the circuit court, that whatever further proceedings it would have because of the continuing nature of the injunction, those proceedings could flesh that out more appropriately. And I think part of the problem is that the record on appeal now does not have all of the legislative history that went into the passage of this ordinance and a few other matters that are related to whether or not it's, there's things that are not in the record here at the appellate court, so it would be difficult to even just brief on a legal basis its effect.
Right. I guess one of the conceptual concerns is we have final judgment in this case, and the injunction is not the only thing that we have. We have all these other issues that are raised in various appeals, and I guess, frankly, there's some reluctance to just give everybody a do-over based on an ordinance that we don't understand what your position is or what the impact is. It seems that it changes the landscape, but we don't know what that change is, and we've got quite a record already in this case.
That's right. Well, the county argues that it changes the landscape, and I think that's one of the arguments that would have to be discussed with the circuit court, whether in fact it does change the landscape.
Are you amenable to an appellate conference or mediation? Do you think that is fruitful, or do you think this is something that has to be...
We're not opposed to a Rule 33 conference. I think that the devil is in the details. And I think that the only thing that is stopping these appeals from ending before we have to get to the merits of it is how this matter gets sent back to the circuit court. I think that that's, and so for a Rule 33 conference, I don't think we have any opposition. We wouldn't have any opposition to that.
But isn't your position, as with Ms. Lovell, that essentially the further proceedings before the circuit court would necessarily entail addressing the preliminary injunction? That is, as I understand her position, the key issue for remand and further proceedings in the circuit court based on representations today. Is that your position as well?
Yes, that would, if the matter were dismissed, all of the appeals were dismissed, and the matter was remanded to the circuit court, it would be addressed
not include the attorney's fees issue, for example?
That's correct.
Okay. Any more questions? Okay. Mr. Ogilmore?
Thank you.
Good morning. In response to the motion for remand, both counsel have indicated that there have been settlement negotiations ongoing between the parties. I have not been in privy with the settlement negotiations between the county and Mr. Collins and Mr. Gerla, but I have had my own settlement negotiations with Mr. Wong and the county of Maui. As Ms. Lovell said, it's at a point where we are not quite there, where we have to be. We don't have an executed settlement agreement. All the terms have not been finalized and hashed out. And so at this point, I do think it might be fruitful to have an appellate conference, pursuant to Rule 33, because that would allow the parties to continue the negotiations and hash out these details as to how we get back into circuit court and you know, how we go forward in circuit court and what we do with the ongoing injunction and so forth. So, and that was my request, is to get a continuance of the oral argument and then have this appellate conference held.
So what is your position on what would happen on a remand? What would be the vehicle for what would be the issue that we were remanding for further review by the circuit court?
To be quite honest, it came up last week in my discussions with Mr. Wong. I kept asking Mr. Wong, well, where are we in regards to the settlement negotiations and what's going to happen in regards to the appeal? And so I'm not sure how long Mr. Wong and the plaintiff's counsel have had these discussions, but I haven't had enough time to actually think things through, so to speak, and how everything's going to happen.
Right. So right now, basically, you're unclear, and we've only had the motion for 2 days as well. So we recognize that. But so right now, you don't have a clear picture as to what would be happening on remand either.
Yes.
Okay.
Thank you. Okay. Thank you very much. With that, we will take the motion under advisement, and we'll now commence the argument on the merits.
May it please the court. Aloha and good morning. I am Lance Collins, and I'm arguing the case on behalf of the plaintiffs, appellants, and cross-appellees and appellees. The circuit court below denied our request for attorney's fees based on the private attorney general doctrine, because it found that the first and second prong of the doctrine applied, it found that the third prong was not met. And just briefly, the first prong asks whether or not what is the strength or societal importance of the public policy indicated by the litigants? And the trial court felt that there was significant strength and societal importance of the public policy indicated.
Well, didn't the trial court sort of reconsider that first issue? I mean, that's a position of the other parties, at least.
Well, he sort of, in the April 23rd hearing, he sort of kind of talked in great detail and seemed to be less certain about sort of the overall applicability of anything, because the second Superferry case had just come back down. And then he said, I think it was at page 10 of the transcript there, that he thought that the appellate court would be able to sort everything out most efficiently. But he does go in at length into, into what exactly was vindicated by the litigation. And what he says, among other things, is that that the litigation was it helped support the rule of law. It helped clarify whether or not county officials could simply ignore zoning ordinances by fiat. There's an issue of separation of powers and the design of the charter. We also would argue that implicated, and this was in a variety of our pleadings, but not articulated as well, in part because the law had not yet stated it, but the zoning ordinance is an environmental law that the overall zoning law scheme that was adopted in Chapter 46 was based upon, in part, Article 11, Section 9 of the state constitution, and we did do a supplemental citation regarding the Ala Loop owners case. With regard to the second prong, the test is the necessity of private enforcement and the magnitude of the resultant burden on plaintiffs. And as the record indicates, most of the plaintiffs are elderly, retired local folks who, you know, worked their whole lives and 40 years ago, 30 years ago, bought their houses. And as the trial court stated at the February 24th, 2009 hearing, there seems to be nothing on the horizon indicating that the county was going to sua sponte enforce the 30-foot requirement on its own out of some private feeling of guilt for what had been created here. And what, of course, he was referring to is by the time the summary judgment order had been entered, fill had been placed on the adjacent land up, in some places, beyond 30 feet, which would be higher than the ceilings here. And so when people used to have a ravine with Kiawe Forest and the West Maui Mountains in the background, now they have a 40-foot wall of dirt with several layers of retaining walls and a vinyl fence at the top of it. With respect to just these homeowners, no one was going to enforce the zoning ordinance. And when they filed the suit, the county opposed this. In every single motion, every single aspect of this case, the county opposed, was recalcitrant. The developers filed motion after motion after motion. I think the record has 16,000 pages in it. And crashed my computer a few times trying to look through it. It was overwhelming. And then in the middle of all of this, then the plaintiffs were required to notify thousands of landowners that were around the Maui Lani Project District to satisfy the court's concerns about indispensable parties. And that was no easy task. It was $10,000, I believe, or something close to that.
I mean, just to clarify that point, I thought I saw something in the briefs where there were like 900 notices. Where does the thousands come from?
Well, I think what happened was that the first list of who everybody that was supposed to be notified when it came to us, somehow between the time it came from the county to the mailing service here in Honolulu that Mr. Gerlach hired, there was some problem with the city, and so notices had to be sent out essentially twice because there was an issue. So, yes, there were only, I believe, 900 sets of landowners, but most of them had to be notified twice. And it is true that those costs in the end were paid by the county because of the award of the trial court. With respect to the second prong of the burden on plaintiffs, it was significant. These are more than half of them are retired folks on fixed income that bought their houses 40 years ago. And so without the services of Mr. Gerlach and myself, it would not, nothing would have ever happened. They would now be having houses looking down at their houses or through their windows from 40 feet above had this not occurred. And so the second prong of the private attorney general doctrine was what was satisfied. With respect to the third prong, That's, I think, where the trial court had the most difficulty addressing. And as we cited both in our opening briefs and in our latest supplemental citations to authority, that apparently is a, in court, trial courts that do have to deal with the private attorney general doctrine, this seems to be an issue that most trial courts end up struggling with, is this third prong.
Mr. Collins, if I could ask you just directly, the third prong under the Sierra Club is the number of people standing to benefit from the decision. And so from the people that you represent, the clients you represent, what is that number?
Well, the trial court found that Judge August agreed that everybody that surrounds the Maui Lani Project District would directly benefit from that. And the question is, well, how many people is that?
I mean, to be clear, you only represent the Karangu and the individuals listed on the caption, is my understanding. I mean, there's never been anything in the record where any kind of representation of a class or anything like that was.
No. We do not represent a class. But like in the second Super Ferry case, although there's this issue about, well, who's really going to, what are the number of people that are going to benefit from this, I think we cited Los Angeles Police Protective League versus the City Council of Los Angeles, and in that case, the league itself represented only 76 police officers that were affected by a $5 a month parking pass or something like that. And the police officers protested to, I guess the City of Los Angeles has some kind of labor relations board specifically for their employees, and that board ruled that, in fact, the police officers and the city had to meet and confer, and they couldn't unilaterally impose even a $5 monthly parking pass. And in that particular case, the appellate court, applying the doctrine and looking at the third prong, said that although the case seems to only narrowly affect 76 police officers, the real issue is whether or not the city government can just sort of ignore the scheme of how powers of government are separated and how laws are created and how they're enforced. And in that case, as in this case, the municipal government just ignored what the law was. And so everybody in the county stands to benefit from that.
One of the interesting things in this case, though, I think that the lower court was concerned with, was that there are other homeowners who may be adversely affected by his ruling. In other words, who have a property in that area that they will not either be able to build on or to reconstruct if damaged, etc. How do you address that concern?
First, any person who would have been adversely affected was notified of the case, and a number of individual landowners did intervene. They also filed appeals, but I believe they were all of those were dismissed. With respect to that, and this gets into some of the other issues related to equitable estoppel and that sort of thing, they may have been adversely affected, but the issue there is that, well, if they're adversely affected by the county having to actually follow the design of how county government is supposed to work, and when they're given the opportunity to intervene in the case and don't, I'm not sure how reasonable it is to consider what impact may be to them, because they don't have a vested right in the mayor ignoring zoning ordinances, and they were all notified, and some did intervene. Some of the people in the New Sand Hills subdivision did in fact intervene and defended their interests. And lastly, I wanted to point out to the case that we sent by letter, the Save Arden Oaks versus Sacramento Board of Zoning Appeals. In that case, It was another issue where there was some kind of special project district type ordinance, and it was argued that that trumped the 30-foot height restriction in Arden Oaks. The trial court ruled in favor of the neighboring homeowners, but denied the attorney's fees based on the private attorney general doctrine because of the third prong. And again, there, the California Court of Appeals believed that the trial court looked too narrowly at what it means for society to be benefited by this type of litigation, and said that all current and future, it is true that all current and future residents would, in the neighborhood would benefit from this ruling, but also everybody in Sacramento County would, because it would help clarify what the powers of the various county officials were with respect to the zoning law.
You know, just if as concisely as you can, the trial court here in his ruling essentially made the injunction effective to the parties here, but not the other Maui Lani District lot owners. Is that correct?
Well, the injunction is directed towards the county.
But with respect to the lot owners that are involved in this lawsuit only?
With respect to the Maui Lani Project District. As a whole.
Didn't he make a distinction between the declaratory judgment and then the injunction?
For purposes of the injunction, it's with respect to the development next to Palama and the development next to the old Sand Hills, the new Sand Hills estate. But it might, because of the declaratory part of the relief that is not encompassed in the injunction, that is applicable to the county throughout the county. There's probably some disagreement about whether it just applies to the Maui Lani Project District or the whole county. And I think Ms. Dembo, who is the trial attorney, did say that and did argue that the declaratory relief would affect the entire county. And in fact, I believe some of the briefs related to some of that clarification did start listing all sorts of developments around the county.
My precise question is, what is the plaintiff's position of the effect of the injunction versus the declaratory relief ordered in the circuit court? What distinction is there?
Well, the injunction, for the Palama lot, it's sort of, you know, the horse is kind of out of the barn already, because there's now a 40-foot mountain of dirt. But the injunction essentially stops houses from then being built on top of that, so people wouldn't be looking 70 feet up at mountains right next to their house.
The Palama lot is within the Sand Hills project where the fairway is.
No, I'm sorry. The Palama Drive is adjacent to the Lot 1D, the fairways project. So the injunctive relief was very much is very much important to the specific lot owners, whereas the declaratory relief, I think, is what more directly impacts everybody in the county, and with respect to how the county's scheme of separation of powers and the delegation of powers occurs. Thank you.
Okay, thank you.
Good morning again. I neglected to acknowledge my associate, Michelle Thompson, who is here assisting me today. I believe in a way we put the cart before the horse talking about attorney's fees, because of course you have to be a prevailing party in order to have the attorney's fees in the first place. We believe that the passage of Ordinance 3848, which clarifies that the building height relevant to projects within the Maui Lani Project District and applies retroactively. If the court had had that that new ordinance when it first looked at this case, the plaintiffs would not have been a prevailing party, and the decision would have been much greater. And in fact, Judge August impliedly invited the council to resolve the height definition issue by amending the Norwood County Code.
Ms. Lovell, is there any authority that you can help us with on the issue of change of law, a prevailing by operation of a change of law, the prevailing party then becomes the non-prevailing party?
Well, I think at the essence of this whole dispute was how to interpret a particular ordinance and its application. The question was, did the change in the law in 1991, I believe it was, which put in a new definition of building height, did that apply to project districts that had already been in place? So in this case, it's the county's position that even without this new ordinance, Judge August incorrectly interpreted existing law. However, it's also our position that because the judge more or less invited the county to do something about it, the county council then did pass this ordinance and made it retroactive in order to signal, no, this is what we meant. We meant that the new ordinance would apply to projects going forward, the old height ordinance would apply going backwards. And in fact, in finding of fact number 22, the court said, no amendment to the second height ordinance has ever indicated that the height of residential structures within the Maui Thani Project District is to be determined by standards which existed prior to the passage of the Comprehensive Zoning Ordinance of September 1991. It is our position that the new ordinance, 3848, is that amendment that indicates that the prior height definition applies. In conclusion of Law 70, the court concluded that the council did not exempt the Maui Thani Planning District from the application of the new definition because there was no express grandfathering. Ordinance 3848 provides that express grandfathering. In conclusion of Law 71, the lower court said that the court cannot infer from the council's silence that such a grandfathering exemption exists. Now the council has spoken. In conclusion of Law 72, the court said these tenets, I believe the court meant to say, of statutory interpretation lead the court to conclude that the 1991 change in the definition of building height indicates the council's intention that it be applied prospectively. But now the council has said very explicitly that it applied prospectively only and not retrospectively to project districts that were already in existence. And finally, in conclusion of Law 86, the court said there is no evidence of what definition of height the defendant county approved at phase two, meaning phase two approval of the Maui Thani Project District. But now the council has spoken and said, we want to make absolutely clear that for all projects that got project district phase two approval before a certain date, they are covered by the old height definition. All project districts after that date are covered by the new definition.
Ms. Lovell, this question is a little bit perhaps a tangent to what you're talking about, but it's relevant, I think. You're referencing, for instance, findings of fact by the trial court where he's indicating that there's nothing in the prior pre-1991 yes. ordinances that reference a specific height requirement. And bottom line, my question is, the county does not challenge that finding, correct? I mean, there's nothing in, for instance, the phase one or phase two ordinances or approvals that reference a specific applicable height.
We do certainly challenge his legal conclusions and the accuracy of them. We believe that he engaged in a statutory interpretation process because of ambiguities, frankly, in the language. I think we agree with him that the statute was somewhat ambiguous because it didn't clearly state that the new law provide, you know, applies prospectively only. But we certainly do disagree with the ultimate conclusion he came to.
The I guess
project district, I believe in the record, it states that the project, in the Mawilani project district, that the height shall be 30 feet, but it didn't say from finished grade or from natural grade.
Which is the key
and
question.
There, exactly, and therein lies the difficulty that the parties were faced with. Judge August concluded one way, the county takes the opposite position, and we believe that now with the passage of 3848, that question, that ambiguity has been resolved.
I understand. From a factual perspective in the record, though, what I wanted to get clear is, you folks argue certainly that when phase one and phase two was approved, that this was all pre-91.
Yes.
Okay, so clearly the law was pre-91, the change in the height requirement. However, specifically in those approvals, in those phase one and phase two approvals, am I correct in understanding that there was no specific reference to, for instance, what from which grade the 30 feet would be measured?
That is correct. I believe it says only 30 feet. But
thank
of course,
you.
At that time, there was no need to be, thank you, my colleague has just given me the building height that was applicable. And it basically says building height means the same as height, which, and that the previous definition was vertical distance from finished grade to the highest point of the finished roof surface.
So it's by reference is the argument.
Right, so there was kind of no reason at that point before the 1991 comprehensive zoning ordinance to even go into that distinction, because finished height is generally going to be, you know, the highest height rather than the natural grade.
Thank you.
If I could now turn to another point. We believe that the court erred in granting the injunction here because of the failure of the court to make explicit factual and legal findings and conclusions to meet all of the standards for the granting of an injunction, such as that the plaintiff has suffered an irreparable injury, that remedies are inadequate, monetary damages are inadequate, a balance of the hardship and the public interest would not be harmed by a permanent injunction. I would like to address specifically the balance of the hardships and the public interest. Interestingly enough, there doesn't seem to be much Hawaii law on the subject of standards for a permanent injunction as opposed to preliminary injunction. But the Hawaii Supreme Court did state in Office of Hawaiian Affairs versus Housing and Community Development Corporation of Hawaii, 117 Hawaii 174, that was the ceded lands case which was overruled by the U.S. Supreme Court on other grounds. But in that case, the Supreme Court of Hawaii said, we believe the appropriate test in this jurisdiction for determining whether a permanent injunction is proper is whether the plaintiff has prevailed on the merits, and whether the balance of irreparable damages favors the issuance of a permanent injunction, and whether the public interest supports granting of such an injunction. Now here, in the findings of fact and conclusions of law, we have no direct finding of fact or conclusion of law that the plaintiffs met any of those standards. We have conclusion of law 19, which states somewhat in conclusory fashion, because the court has found standing for the plaintiffs to bring a declaratory action, the court also finds that plaintiffs have standing for their injunctive relief claims as well. That's page 11307 of the record. But we don't have the classic balancing of the hardships analysis. Later on, however, we do have, and this is in conjunction with the attorney's fees motion, in the transcript of the hearing held on February 24th, 2009, that's transcript number 8293 and PDF page 434, the court said, it may be the case that the number of people potentially adversely affected by the decisions may be greater than the number of people like the plaintiffs who are living along the streets adjacent to those subdivisions. We don't see anything like that in his order, nor do we see anything that comes to the opposite conclusion, which I believe by law the court would have to have found in order to have given injunction relief.
Well, if I may ask the same question I asked Mr. Collins, how do you view the distinction between the declaratory relief and the injunctive relief that was granted by the circuit court? He made a distinction, didn't he?
Yes, he did, although I don't believe that it's very clear how he did that. In the order, you have declaratory relief that applies to the entire Maui Lani Project District, but injunctive relief that applies only to two subdivisions. And therefore, my understanding is that he interpreted our height ordinance as applying throughout this very large project district, but issued a permanent injunction only to stop the issuance of building permits in two of its subdivisions. However, the court did acknowledge that there would be individuals harmed who owned lots in those subdivisions. He was absolutely correct that the number of people potentially adversely affected may be greater than those like the plaintiffs. The other thing is, of course, that the plaintiffs originally, I believe their original concern was the height. Okay, I'm almost out of time here. If I could just give 2 minutes to the attorney's fees issue. This court and the Hawaii Supreme Court have awarded attorney's fees in the private attorney general doctrine exactly once, and that was in the Super Ferry case. They acknowledged the doctrine in the Waiahole 2 case and also in the Maui Tomorrow case, but did not award attorney's fees in that case. So we have only the Super Ferry case, or Sierra Club versus Department of Transportation, in which they were awarded. And in that case, of course, you had a law of statewide application. You had plaintiffs who belonged to organizations who did not stand to get anything for themselves. There was no monetary award that was going to go to them. It was a group of environmental groups who took on the state legislature, the governor, and the attorney general's office in order to vindicate rights that they saw arising under Chapter 343, which is our environmental protection statute in the state. And on that ground, the court below ruled that Judge Cardoza of our Second Circuit did not abuse his discretion in ordering attorney's fees. But it is discretionary, and the court here made a careful analysis and decided, based on the factors in the private attorney general doctrine, that in his discretion he was not going to award attorney's fees to this small group of people who started the lawsuits because they had a personal monetary interest. And with that, I will.
One question just related to that. In your mind, when you look at the record, is there any indication as to why the judge granted injunctive relief only as to the two subdivisions as opposed to the declaratory relief that was countywide?
I don't know if I can point to a specific point in the record. Certainly the county throughout argued that not only were indispensable parties not there, and there is no finding, by the way, in the court's ultimate ruling, no finding of fact, no conclusion of law, that all indispensable parties received actual notice. Mm-hmm. Instead, the court decided he was able to craft, he says, because all indispensable parties were not before the court, he would craft the relief in such a way that they were not indispensable parties. And that's about the best that I can do.
Thank you.
Good morning. Ronald Memorial, appearing on behalf of New Sand Hills LLC, BPMPK, and LLC, KCOM Corp, and Sand Hill Estates Community Association. I'm going to refer to those parties as the developers or developers. As you guys know, the incident appeal relates to the issue as to whether the pre-1991 building height definition or the 1991 amendment applies to the subject projects and the Maunganui Project District. As council has indicated, the Maunganui Project District is a large subdivision. It encompasses at least 12 separate residential subdivisions, approximately 1,200 homes. And the subject projects, the Fairways projects and the Sandhill projects, were developed probably at the last tail end of the entire Maunganui Project District, meaning that 10 or 9 or 10 subdivisions had already been constructed and built and sold. The Maunganui Project District was processed pursuant to a 3-approval process where approvals would go to the planning director. They would then submit it to the planning commission. They would have public hearings. People would have the chance to intervene or raise an objection to these Maunganui Project District. And at that point, the planning commission could decide upon whether to grant the approval for the Maunganui Project District. In this case, as provided by Clayton Nishida's declarations, public notice was provided in regards to the public hearings. No one intervened, no one objected. Phase 1 and Phase 2 approvals were granted by the planning commission. And thereafter, the individual subdivisions within the Maunganui Project District then went and got their individual Phase 3 approvals. So that process went on. And in regards to the instant cases, or in regards to the Fairways Project and the Sandhills Project, a lawsuit was filed. A couple lawsuits were filed. And in regards to this case, the trial court committed numerous reversible errors. First and foremost, the trial court erroneously granted the plaintiff's summary judgment motion in regards to the application of the 1991 amendment to the subject projects, despite the fact that genuine issues of material fact existed. In granting the plaintiff's motion and finding that Mayor Arakawa made a unilateral and unauthorized decision, the trial court completely ignored countervailing evidence that was submitted to the court in the form of sworn declarations, in the form of the mayor's in-court testimony in response to a motion for a preliminary injunction. Specifically, the county's former planning director, Mike Foley, submitted in his declaration that the mayor and other county officials were advised by Corporation Council that the 1991 amendment could not be applied to each and every project. Certain project approvals or vested rights have to be recognized and basically, they're also told that the county had lost a number of lawsuits on this point. Mr. Foley also stated that a collective decision was made with the input from Corporation Council that the pre-1991 height definition would be applied to the subject projects, based in part on the fact that the subject projects had secured Phase 1 and Phase 2 approvals prior to the enactment of the 1991 amendment. Finally, that as the county planning director and the official responsible for enforcing zoning ordinances, Mr. Foley ratified and agreed with that collective decision. Judge August completely ignored that declaration in making his decision. Judge August also ignored the declaration submitted by Clayton Yoshida of the county's planning department. Mr. Yoshida stated in his declarations that the county considered the unilateral development agreement to be the type of agreement provided under HRS Chapter 46. The county concluded that the 1991 amendment did not apply to the subject projects and that the Phase 1 and Phase 2 approvals were the last discretionary approvals issued by the county in regards to these projects and that those approvals predated the 1991 amendment. Now, Mayor Arakawa, as I indicated, testified in court that he was brought or came, he was advised that there was an issue as to how would the county go about enforcing the 1991 amendment to certain projects. He was advised that the county, after the enactment of the 1991 amendment, had been using a flexible approach to the enforcement. They would look at, you know, the entire grading plan and so forth. At that point, he ordered a number of meetings between county officials, department heads, and based upon the input from Corporation Council, they came up with a collective decision. Again, Judge August totally disregarded all those testimony in making his decision.
Counsel, I have a question about that. The evidence is that he took these actions. Was there, or what is your position in terms of whether the mayor had the authority to take those actions?
Well, the way I look at it is that when he found out about this issue, he asked the department heads to come up and Corporation Council to come up with a delineation point by which when we can enforce the 1991 amendment based upon vested rights and secured approvals. And what they came up with was a collective decision that for projects that had received phase one and phase two approvals prior to the enactment of the 1991 amendment, those projects would be governed by the pre-1991 definition.
And that proposal was supported by what authority? I mean, was that an authorized, that's a decision. Was there something that authorized that method?
I think what has to be done or has to be looked at is the county's planning director, Mike Foley. By charter, he is the person charged with ensuring that the county's zoning ordinances are enforced. And what Judge August did not take into account is that Mike Foley, the planning director, participated in those discussions, agreed with the collective decision, and ratified that decision. Now, what ultimately happened, unfortunately, is that Mayor Arakawa signed a letter where he says, I made a decision or administrative decision or something to that effect. That's the unfortunate part. Because in actuality, a collective decision that was ratified and agreed to by the planning director did take place.
Well, one of the things that I think the judge looked at was the fact that Mayor Arakawa not only sent the letter to the developers, but he sent the letter to Mr. Foley. The thing I think that the trial court was troubled with was that, in fact, Mr. Foley didn't make that decision. In fact, the finding was that the mayor made the decision, right? I mean, that's what you're challenging.
That's what I'm challenging, because Mike Foley and a number of other, you know, officials will say that they were all part of this discussion and they all agree with the decision.
So your point is, look at Mike Foley's declaration and that created a genuine issue of material fact.
And that declaration was completely ignored and not addressed by the trial court. And how does that impact what the judge ultimately or the trial court ultimately ruled on the various affirmative defenses in regards to the vested rights defense? I think the case law provides that a developer secures vested rights to proceed with a project upon the issuance of the last final discretionary approval. In this case, the phase one and phase two approvals were issued prior to the 1991 amendment. What that means is that a subsequently enacted ordinance should not apply to these projects within the Maui Lahaina Project District. Further supporting the vesting of the rights for the developers to develop under the pre-1991 definition is the fact in this case, Maui Lahaina Partners, the original or the master developer, signed a unilateral development agreement with the county. And that provided for the fact that in that Maui Lahaina Project District, 20% of the houses had to be deemed affordable.
Mr. Obomori, if I could ask you the same question I asked Ms. Lovell, I mean, in terms of those phase one and phase two approvals, though, I mean, one of the key questions I believe under the vested rights issue is how clear those rights were. In other words, number one, really, was there still discretion left by the county because, for instance, with regards to that the height issue, in those documents, there's nothing that specifically addresses the definition of height. It's all by reference. Is that correct?
That's true.
Okay. And obviously, your argument is, well, the only law at that time was that height was based from the finished grade. So that's the argument.
Yes.
In total, right?
Yes.
Okay. Because there's nothing in those documents themselves that would reference
that's
the height.
True.
Okay.
Now, I would note is that you mentioned, or in prior discussions, you talked about when the 1991 amendment was enacted. At that point, when they enacted that ordinance that redefined the building height definition, they modified other sections within the Maui County Code. So they could have made sure that it applied to this Maui County Project District, which is Chapter 19.78, I believe.
The exemptions that were in that legislation.
I see the rest of the issues, I just rest on my briefs.
Thank you. Mr. Collins?
Your Honors, the county refers to the Maui Tomorrow case as part of its argument about why plaintiffs are not entitled to attorney's fees in this case. In that case, the Maui Tomorrow versus the Board of Land and Natural Resources, the problem there was that the BLNR had assumed that it was someone else's job or duty to do what they were in fact supposed to do. And so the court there said that prong two was not satisfied because this wasn't an issue of the government just abandoning its duty, but in fact just not understanding what its duty was. The second Superferry case distinguished that and said in the second Superferry case, the Department of Transportation, there was no question that they didn't think that somebody else had a duty to go through the environmental assessment process, but they in fact did abandon their duty to comply with the Hawaii Environmental Protection Act. And this case is like the Superferry case. There wasn't a question about who was supposed to be enforcing zoning ordinances. The mayor's letters did not say, well, I yield to the Department of Public Works or the state government about who's supposed to enforce this 30-foot height restriction. He said, well, I'm the head person of the county, and I'm ordering the people under me to not enforce this rule. That the developers have come in, and I've decided that we're not going to follow this rule, follow this ordinance. And of course, Mr. Foley, who is solely subject to the pleasure of the mayor, the prosecuting attorney and the corporation council do require county council approval when they're appointed, and if they're removed, that's not exactly the same case for the rest of the county directors. So in this particular instance, even if the mayor wrote the letter 2 years after the fact, after he orally told the planning director what his view of all of this was, what his decision was, it had the effect of having the all of the county not enforce the zoning ordinance with respect to these developments. And in terms of whether or not there was some confusion about whether the Maui Lani Project District should have been was grandfathered, or Judge August, in his findings and conclusions, showed that in fact there was no historical interpretation of how the height restriction was applied, and that it kind of changed, that it wasn't even considered until 2003, and then it seemed like the county was clearly applying the 30 feet from natural or finished grade, but then the developer didn't like that, had these closed door meetings, and then the mayor wrote his letters. But had the county done its duty, it would have discovered that in Ordinance 2031, Section 9, that did adopt the 1991 height restriction definition did have a, Section 9 is a grandfathering provision. And in fact, there were developments that had gotten approvals before these, before the height restriction amendment that were grandfathered in. But this is part of the issue of the county wholly abandoning its duty, that there was no research into the history of any of this, nothing. It was just a simple closed-door meeting, and the mayor made a decision, and from that moment on, the entire county apparatus opposed any kind of requests that this be reconsidered. There were no public hearings for this closed-door meeting that the county, that the mayor had with his directors and the developer. This completely did not follow any of the procedures that are set out in the county charter with respect to changes in land use ordinances. The Maui County Charter requires that all proposed land use ordinances and amendments thereto are supposed to go to the Maui Planning Commission. None of that occurred. The mayor met with the developer and a couple of his department heads and then issued an administrative decision, as he called it. There was no rulemaking pursuant to Chapter 91. So with respect to the abandoning of the duty of the government, this falls squarely on that. And the adoption of Ordinance 3848 that the county is arguing now makes essentially overrules Judge August's decision by trying to expressly grandfather in the Maui Lani Project District. Whether or not that in fact has that effect, the intent that they tried to pass a law to overrule Judge August, I think, continues to show the burden that plaintiffs had, that the county was so single-mindedly focused on opposing the enforcement of the zoning ordinance that they even go so far as to try to amend the definition to just make the whole thing go away, shows that the plaintiffs really did have a very strong burden. There's no evidence in the record on appeal or this particular ordinance that's been passed that the county at any time said, well, you know, we have a duty here towards the zoning ordinance and maybe we've made a mistake or anything along those lines. A wholesale abandonment of its duty and opposing plaintiffs at every angle in trying to get them to enforce it. Also, with respect to the county looking at the history of these ordinances, and one ordinance is the Maui Lani Project District Processing Ordinance, and one ordinance is the Height Restriction Ordinance, and looking at those, what they would have found in the Phase 2 approval, and it's in the record, and I believe we cite it, is the landscape requirements of the Phase 2 approval. And it says that new developments should blend in with existing neighborhoods, and when that's not possible, tropical landscaping features should buffer the difference. But in this case, that wasn't followed at all. There's other requirements, Phase 2, that whenever if a developer sells their interest to another developer of any part of this project, that the Planning Commission will be notified and approve of it, and there's no evidence of any of that occurring. And in fact, that the Phase 2, the Maui Lani Project District processing requirements requires things like the heights and the grading and architectural plans, and this first Phase 2 approval doesn't include any of those things. And all of these issues that the county said, well, we had to abandon our duty because the developer was threatening to sue us, there's no evidence in the record that the county took any steps to even verify or justify that. There's no legal opinions that were issued. There's nothing along those lines. There's just a letter. The mayor had a meeting, and he made his decision, and he told his people what was going to happen. And then at some point, someone said, well, we need to have a letter. I don't want to be the county official that ends up having to hang for this, so I need a letter. And so the mayor issued a couple of letters memorializing his oral decision. And it's just abandonment. There's nothing in the record that shows that at any point the county took up its duty. And that's very much different than the Maui Tomorrow case or the Waiapoli case. Plaintiffs are the only ones that took this all the way and insisted that the zoning ordinance be enforced. And the county opposed them at every step and said, we've abandoned our duty and we're not going to budge. And if you try to make us, we will oppose you in every way we can, including the issue of having to notify hundreds of landowners, which ended up being thousands of notices, or excuse me, over 1,000 notices of all of this stuff. I mean, it was a tremendous burden. I think that plaintiffs are very thankful that Mr. Gerlach took this case, because I don't believe that it would have been possible without Mr. Gerlach, Mr. Dewis, and I doing it together as a team, because this was a very, very difficult process and procedure. And as the cases that we cite show, that it's for those reasons that plaintiffs are entitled to their attorney's fees under the Private Attorney General doctrine. Thank you.
Thank you very much. I'll take the matter under advisement.